From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union. The Cuban economy is a disaster. Bicycles are replacing cars. Oxen are replacing tractors. Journalist Andres Oppenheimer spent 5 months in Cuba over the past year and a half. We'll talk about his new book, Castro's Final Hour. Also, Guys and Dolls. The Broadway revival is a huge hit. We'll hear the story of how Guys and Dolls first became a musical. We'll talk with one of the producers of the original production, Cy Feuer. And Soviet emigre David Gurevich watches the Olympics. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Astronauts aboard the space shuttle Atlantis are now in the process of retrieving the tethered satellite, following a series of snags that forced NASA to call off the $376 million experiment. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
Yesterday's problems with the tethered satellite left it just 860 feet away from the shuttle instead of the 12 miles planned for the electricity-generating experiment. And the problems got worse today when the tether got jammed inside the 39-foot boom that cradles the satellite when it's at the shuttle. The tether wouldn't move out, and it wouldn't move in. So this afternoon, NASA told the astronauts just to retrieve the satellite instead of struggling to continue the experiment. The astronauts managed to free the snag by telescoping the boom in a few feet, drawing the tether tight inside the boom, and then telescoping the boom out again. Then they reeled the satellite back to the shuttle. Scientists will get almost no information from the tether experiment, and that makes this one of the most disappointing shuttle flights ever. But if the gear is retrieved, they could try again on another flight. This is Richard Harris in Washington.
Federal civil rights charges have been filed against four white Los Angeles policemen accused of beating black motorist Rodney King. The four officers won acquittals on all but one of the state charges against them in April, a verdict that touched off riots in Los Angeles that resulted in the deaths of 52 people. The federal indictments unsealed today charge officers Lawrence Powell, Timothy Wind, and Theodore Briseno with aiding and abetting each other in beating King under color of law. The fourth defendant, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, was charged with failing to prevent an unlawful assault by the officers under his command. A U.S. attorney told reporters that the charges will not deal with allegations that the beating was racially motivated. Tens of thousands of black protesters marched peacefully in South African cities today to demand an end to white minority rule. The largest demonstration in Pretoria drew 50,000 people who marched to the government's executive office building to hear African National Congress President Nelson Mandela. NPR's Ann Cooper reports.
President F.W. de Klerk was meeting with his cabinet when the marchers arrived at Pretoria's Union Buildings, seat of the white minority regime's executive power. Hundreds of police and soldiers guarded the terraces leading up to the buildings. With their assault weapons, they created a bizarre backdrop for Mandela as he spoke to the protesters about his vision of a democratic South Africa. The march, which dispersed quietly after Mandela's speech, followed a two-day ANC led general strike. Millions of South Africans observed the stay away to press the ANC's demands for an interim government and democratic parliamentary elections. I'm Ann Cooper reporting.
The Dow Industrials lost 19 points today. This is NPR. Thousands of anti-government demonstrators rallied today in the Central African Republic to protest the murder of a popular opposition leader. As many as 100,000 people gathered for the funeral of Jean-Claude Kanjougo, who was beaten to death by soldiers as he led a group of unarmed pro-democracy protesters. The mourners called for the overthrow of André Kolingba, the military dictator who seized control of the Central African Republic in 1981. They also condemned the government of France for allegedly supporting dictators in the former French colonies in Africa. A pair of young activists has recruited two veteran politicians to help launch a campaign asking national candidates to pledge to cut the budget deficit in half by 1996 or leave office. NPR's Carol Ann Clark reports.
The Lead or Leave campaign has attracted the support of Senator Warren Rudman, who cited the growing deficit as his reason for not running again, and unsuccessful presidential candidate Paul Tsongas. The former Massachusetts senator says it's not too much to ask candidates to put their careers on the line when you consider the alternative.
It is my view that this country is heading towards generational warfare, that as time goes on, the trends that are now out there continue, that it will eventually be young versus old in a kind of bitter division this country has never seen before.
Rudman described the goal of cutting the $333 billion deficit in half within 6 years as eminently doable. He says he and Tsongas will be announcing a group next month called the Concord Coalition, which will try and keep the deficit a top issue during the fall campaign. I'm Carol Ann Clark in Washington.
Former junk bond king Michael Milken has gotten a reduction in his prison sentence for securities fraud. U.S. District Judge Kimball Wood ruled today that Milken will have to serve only 2 years of his original 10-year prison sentence. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Cuba is still a communist country, in spite of the fact that the country, which was its greatest ally and greatest source of consumer goods, no longer exists. Without the Soviet Union, Cuba is in big trouble, facing terrible shortages and economic disaster. The American trade embargo is still in effect, and there's even a movement to tighten restrictions. It's not easy for American journalists to get prolonged access to Cuba, but my guest Andres Oppenheimer managed to spend 5 months there over the past year and a half. He also made several trips to Cuba in the 80s. Oppenheimer is the author of the new book Castro's Final Hour, about life in Cuba after the collapse of the Soviet Union. Oppenheimer is a senior foreign correspondent at the Miami Herald. He's covered Latin America for 15 years. Oppenheimer says his time in Cuba showed him that it's over for Castro.
5 years ago, when I went to Cuba and I stopped people on the street, it was very hard, almost impossible, to get a criticism of the Cuban Revolution or of Fidel Castro. Everybody will tell you, this country is great, we are very advanced in health and education and this and that. 3 years ago, when the things started collapsing in the Soviet bloc, a lot of people would tell you, well, we have some problems, this is not an easy time, but the revolution has accomplished many things, has brought about many social changes for the better. A year ago, many people would say things are really bad. And today, people are not only criticizing the Cuban Revolution as it is today, but are also starting to point at Fidel Castro himself.
I think a lot of the discontent in Cuba has to do with the shortages that Cuba has been experiencing since the collapse of the Soviet Union. What has Castro's plan been for making up for the things that the Soviet Union is no longer supplying Cuba?
Castro has come up with something he has called special period in times of peace, which is the equivalent of a war economy. He has started importing bicycles to replace cars, oxen to replace tractors, etc., etc. Since 1989, Cuba has become a different country. You wouldn't recognize it today. On the streets, you see people, I tell in my book anecdotes about me, for instance, one day driving on a narrow street in Old Havana and almost bumping into a 60-year-old grandmother who was riding her bike for the first time because she could not go to work in the bus anymore because they were cutting back on bus routes because of lack of shortages of gasoline. So this woman was forced to start riding a bike at age 60, and this is one of the many things that you see happening in Cuba every day. They're going back to, the way they would put it, to the Stone Ages.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's electricity outages for about 8 hours each day, I think.
Right now, there are electricity outages like 8 hours a day, but it's not just the shortages of food and almost everything else. And by the way, one of the interesting things I found in Cuba talking about shortages is that a lot of people are more irked by the shortage of soap and deodorant than, believe it or not, of food. Because,
yeah, why is that?
Well, I have a wonderful interview with a friend of mine who told me, you know, this may be difficult to understand for you living in the West, living in the United States, but I personally resent more the shortage of soap than of food because you can trick your stomach by drinking coffee, he told me. I drink coffee several times a day, he said. But try not shaving for 2 or 3 days. Try not washing your hand with soap for 2 or 3 days. And your self-esteem goes down and you feel terrible. And it turns you into a different person. That's something that really gets on our nerves, he said. And he said, you know, you foreign journalists, you keep talking about the food shortages, but you miss like these little details of daily life which put a lot of strain on the Cuban population.
In 1990, Castro ordered the mobilization of 200,000 Havana residents to farms. Is that program still in effect, and what were the reasons behind it?
Well, the reasons was that Cuba depended on the Soviet Union for much of its food imports, and suddenly when these food imports started flowing into Cuba, he needed to provide food for his people. So he started this mass forced mobilization from Cubans from the city to the countryside. I went to the countryside to see this this process, and regardless of all the official statements that it's doing great, it's a big camp. That's what it is. People go there, are forced to go.
You mean like summer camp or detention camp?
No, summer camp. Nobody takes it very seriously. They're forced to go. They don't want to go. And imagine, they don't work that much. Imagine if they put you or me, people accustomed to city life, to grow potatoes. We don't know how to do it. So people who are into the agribusiness sector in Cuba, a lot of them are very skeptical because they say this is a big charade. We're not going to feed our population by taking accountants and a philosophy professor from Havana and have them, you know, growing potatoes.
You point out that over 55% of the Cuban population was born after the revolution, and the group of the population most disenfranchised from the revolution is the youth.
That's incredible, because it was exactly the opposite to what I expected to find. I was interviewing once in order to find out what the Cuban youth thought. I wanted not only to talk with the young people hanging out at the Malecón at the Seaside Avenue and Boulevard in Havana, but I decided to do something different. So I said, you know, how about looking for Che Guevara's grandchildren and look at what has become of them? It was very funny because I was interviewing one of Che Guevara's daughters, and suddenly I see this kid walking into the room with long hair, earrings, this 17-year-old kid. And I started talking to him, and suddenly it dawned on me that he was a much more interesting interview than his daughter, because he was a heavy metal rock musician who sang his songs in English and was very angry at Fidel Castro and at his revolution for being what he called an institution and a repressive one. And he told me, this revolution is in ruins. And he gave me a lot of examples about why a young kid like him is against the current course of the Cuban Revolution.
What's one of the examples he gave you?
Well, for instance, he said, look at me. I wore long hair and earrings. When I go to the street, the police will grab me and take me to the police station and cut my hair. Imagine the irony, he said. When Raul Castro came down from the mountain during the revolution, he was wearing a ponytail, just like me. And now he and his people in power are taking kids like me and cutting our hair forcefully. So he said, the revolution has turned into an institution. So for these kids, this revolution is a revolution of grandparents, a revolution of people in Fidel's generation, who, by the way, occupy most positions of power, who are not allowing the younger generation to move up and to do their thing.
Castro is trying to build the economic future of Cuba on the tourist industry. And you say he's created virtually an apartheid system because Cubans are more or less banned from the tourist hotels and the tourist restaurants. What's the point of that?
Well, that's the most incredible irony of the Cuban Revolution. And that's why I say when I talk in that chapter about tourism, that the Cuban Revolution has gone full circle. In 1959, one of the big things of the Cuban Revolution that created so much illusions, not only in Cuba but in Latin America, was the fact of finishing with prostitution, with apartheid system that prevented blacks and mulattoes and Cubans from joining in the pleasures and the casinos that the tourists were enjoying, that the revolution had ended that. And now, 33 years later, we have in Havana a new apartheid system where the Cubans cannot go into the hotels where we foreigners are staying, where the Cuban people cannot go into a store to buy soap or to buy, you know, goods that are available only to Westerners, only to Western visitors, and where Cubans cannot even mingle with the foreigners in specially designated places like hotels that are only for foreigners.
Mm-hmm. So what is the point of keeping Cubans out of the tourist hotels and restaurants?
Well, to begin with, the Cuban government wants to prevent the political contamination of people. Contact with Westerners promotes ideas that the Cuban Communist Party is not very happy with. And that's precisely why this policy won't work, because Fidel Castro is creating very limited islands of efficiency within the Cuban system, tourism being one of them. But he refuses to expand them for fear that his people will become contaminated by democratic thoughts. That's why he's refusing to expand these islands of efficiency. And that's why the system won't work, because if you take the profits out of tourism and throw them into an inefficient economy, you're throwing money into a bottomless barrel. So tourism will not save the Cuban economy.
In the meantime, the jobs in the tourist industry have become the prestige jobs.
Right. Every Cuban I have met in the several months I spent in Havana, I met a lot of people, doctors, professors. A lot of young people want to get into tourism because that's the only way they have access to foreigners, and getting access to foreigners is the only way to get soap, shampoo, all the things that are available only to foreigners. And many of them, their only chance to meet a foreigner who perhaps would fall in love with them and take them out of the country.
So the tourist hotels and restaurants are protected from the shortages?
For foreigners.
For foreigners, right.
The hotels and tourism shops are only for foreigners and are pretty well stocked. But only foreigners can go. And a lot of Cubans approach you on the street asking that you please go to the diplotiendas, which is what they're called, and buy something for them, which they can't get. For instance, soap. And the other thing, now more than ever, because what used to happen all these years was that the thousands of Soviets in Havana especially and in Cienfuegos, they were big black marketeers. A lot of spouses of Soviet technicians went to the diplo stores, to these foreigners-only stores, and bought big quantities of soap or shampoo or this or that, and then sold them to their Cuban neighbors in their neighborhoods. But now that the Soviet technicians are gone, there's a shortage of people to get these items.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Andres Oppenheimer, senior correspondent for the Miami Herald and author of the new book, Castro's Final Hour. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Andres Oppenheimer is my guest, author of the new book, Castro's Final Hour. One of the things that's happening now is a lot of the Cuban exiles who have been living in Miami are planning for their return to Cuba. You write that one thing that both Castro and his opponents agree on is that the Miami exiles are politically out of touch. How?
Well, let's qualify that. There are several sectors within the Miami Cuban exile community. The most extreme right-wing sectors of that community play right into Castro's hands because they want pretty much a civil war in Cuba. They want an armed struggle to bring down Fidel Castro. And a lot of them are talking about recovering their properties. So a lot of people I talk to in Cuba who don't like Fidel Castro and who want to get rid of him fear for their lives because they say, you know, we want a peaceful transition to democracy. We don't want a civil war. And others say, look, I've been living in this house for 30 years. I don't want somebody who is living a good life in Miami all this time when I was sacrificing myself and living really poorly to come any day, knock on my door, and get me out of this house. But I have to say that the majority of the Cuban exiles have matured a lot in recent years, and they know and understand that they can't go into Cuba and sort of recover what once was theirs, that the country has changed, and that they have to play a constructive role.
You think there'd be a big racial division if a lot of exiles returned because it was white and lighter-skinned Cubans who were the ones to leave prominently?
Cuba has changed substantially over the past 30 years. Almost all of the Cubans who left Cuba, especially in the early years after the revolution, were white. More than 95% of the Cuban exiles in Miami are white. If you live in Miami the way I do and you go to Calle Ocho, which is where the center of Little Havana, you see a completely different crowd than if you go to Cuba and you stand on 23rd Street and Malecón, which is sort of an equivalent place in Havana. Cuba has become a darker, racially more black, more mulatto place than it used to be. And many of these blacks and mulattoes in Cuba have benefited from the revolution in the sense that they are now living in the homes left behind by the white Cubans who fled to Miami and New Jersey. And I would not say that they support the revolution because, look, the general discontent is growing so fast that I would say that without any doubt that Fidel Castro is at the rock bottom of his popular support ever. But these people have something to lose, and they want assurances that if the situation changes, they won't be kicked out of their places.
Mm-hmm. Both President Bush and presidential hopeful Bill Clinton want to tighten trade restrictions on Cuba. What effect do you think that would have?
I think that's political posturing because, right now the United States doesn't have a real Cuba policy. It has a short-term Miami policy, if you want to call it that way. Our whole policy on Cuba is based on domestic political considerations. I think that the kind of measures of tightening the trade embargo they are talking about now, I don't think they will be implemented after the election. And I think it would be counterproductive. I have sort of a middle-of-the-road position on this. I don't think the U.S. should lift the embargo right away because, that will be rewarding a repressive system. On the other hand, I think that tightening the embargo would be giving Fidel Castro a new excuse to go to Latin America and to Spain and claim to be the poor David fighting this aggressive Goliath and win a little bit of sympathy at a time when everybody is turning his back on him.
How do you think Castro keeps managing to hang on?
Well, the obvious answer is the only thing that still works in Cuba to some degree is a repressive system, a police state. But also, although he is having less popular support than ever, there are some sectors in Cuba who are afraid of the future. And the political system, the Communist Party, does what it can to fuel these fears. For instance, you open up Granma, the official paper, every day, and there are stories about unemployed in Poland, about people in East Germany, in what used to be East Germany, fired from their jobs, etc., etc. So I tell, I found very funny anecdotes of people who have make-work jobs that sound, ridiculous to somebody coming from the West. And these people know that in a market economy, they will lose their jobs right away because their jobs don't make any economic sense. So these people, and I, if I remember correctly, of the 3.5 million people listed by the Cuban Census Bureau in the Cuban workforce, 1.1 million hold what the Cuban Census Office calls non-productive jobs. A lot of these people would be out of the job in a matter of hours if a market economy replaced the current system. So these people, even though they don't agree with Fidel and many of them would like the system to change, they fear for their future.
Why do you think Castro never opened up his thinking to perestroika-style reforms?
I think he lacks the political courage to do it because, look, one of the interesting things I found in Cuba was that We, here in the States, when we talk about Cuba, we keep comparing Cuba with Eastern Europe. And when I was talking with Cuban officials, members of the Politburo, the one thing that struck me was that they were not bringing up the case of Eastern Europe. The one thing that was always in their minds was Nicaragua. And they kept saying, we will not make the mistake that the Sandinistas did in Nicaragua. We are not going to call for elections or open up the system in the midst of our worst economic crisis ever, because that's a recipe for losing, and we won't do that.
What do you think is going to happen when Castro is no longer in power, and you think that's pretty inevitable?
Hopefully, and a lot of people of the most conservative Cuban exiles don't agree with this. Hopefully, there will be a peaceful transition where many of the Cuban Communist Party officials who now are in government positions will remain in some capacity in Cuba, and there will be a bloodless, peaceful transition, pretty much like in Russia, because otherwise there's going to be an incredible civil war in Cuba. There's so much accumulated resentment. In every block, you'll find people who tell you, you see, that person across the street, he is responsible for me having spent 10 years in an agricultural camp because he, you know, had something bad to say about me to the Communist Party political commissar. And there's a lot of fear that the minute Fidel falls, everybody's going to take to the streets and kill his neighbor. There's a lot of accumulated resentment.
Can I ask what country you're from?
Argentina. I was a journalist in Argentina, and I left in 1976 when a right-wing military regime took over in Argentina. And I went to study to New York, to Columbia University, because I didn't agree with that regime.
Do you think that being Latin American and having left a military regime helped you get access to people you wanted to talk to in Cuba?
I think so. And also, I had an open mind regarding the Cuban Revolution, like virtually every other person growing up in Latin America when I studied there. I used to see the Cuban Revolution from the distance with a measure of respect and sympathy. These people looked like idealist revolutionaries who were wanting to bring some social benefits to their people. So from the distance, that looked pretty good. And perhaps, I don't know, because I didn't go to Cuba at that time, perhaps that was the case in the 60s and 70s. But when I look at Cuba today, I did not see that much difference between a leftist police state and a rightist police state. When a country puts somebody in prison for 15 years, like the Cuban government did just 3 weeks ago, a person, and I'm talking about just the latest political prisoner, Indamiro Restano, not for taking arms against the regime, because I think every government is entitled to take measures against people who take arms against the government, but just for saying he wants a multi-party system in Cuba, when a system puts somebody in prison just for talking, then I think there's no much difference between a right-wing and a left-wing military regime. They're the same. They're military regimes.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
I appreciate your inviting me.
Andres Oppenheimer is a senior foreign correspondent at the Miami Herald. His new book is Castro's Final Hour. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio. Thank you.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Guys and Dolls is once again one of Broadway's biggest hits. If you've ever seen a production of this great musical, or if you starred in your high school or summer camp production, you can thank Cy Feuer, one of the producers of the original Broadway show. He and his partner decided to create a musical based on Damon Runyon stories, and they hired Frank Lesser to write the score. Coming up, Cy Feuer tells us the story of Guys and Dolls. Also, Soviet emigre David Gurevich watches the Olympics and thinks about cultural chauvinism. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. Four Los Angeles police officers were indicted today on federal civil rights charges in the beating of black motorist Rodney King. The acquittal in April of the officers on most state charges filed against them led to 3 days of deadly rioting. NPR's Ina Jaffe has a report.
The four officers are charged with willfully and intentionally using unreasonable force under color of law in the arrest of Rodney King in March of 1991. Also, Sergeant Stacy Kuhn, the ranking officer at the scene, is charged with failing to take action to stop the assault. The racial motivation of the officers is not an issue in these charges, according to United States Attorney Lourdes Baird. Rather, she said the indictments are based on a citizen's right to be free of unreasonable assault. The four defendants are expected to surrender to authorities tomorrow. If convicted, they each face maximum penalties of 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine. One of the officers, Lawrence Powell, also faces retrial on the one state count of assault on which the jury was deadlocked. The federal investigation into the beating incident is continuing, and there could be additional charges. I'm Ina Jaffe in Los Angeles.
The International Red Cross said today all three main ethnic groups in the former Yugoslavia maintain detention camps. The Red Cross says more than 4,000 people are being held in the camps and that human rights abuses occur daily. Red Cross officials said they visited 9 camps in Bosnia, run by Serbs, Muslims, and Croats. The Red Cross believes other camps exist. United Nations officials said they may hold an urgent meeting next week on the camps. In New York City today, President Bush addressed the annual convention of the Knights of Columbus, a Catholic fraternal group. Don Matheson of member station WNYC reports.
It was a receptive audience for President Bush's homily on moral values and what he calls the evils of abortion. Bush reminded the crowd that he has vetoed abortion rights legislation 7 times, and he stands ready to do it again.
And I promise you again today, no matter the political price, they tell me in this year that it's enormous, I am going to do what I think is right. I'm going to stand on my conscience and let my conscience be my guide when it comes to matters of life.
The president says parental consent should be a requirement before pregnant teens are allowed to have abortions. Bush also used the occasion to renew his calls for educational reform. For National Public Radio, I'm Don Matheson in New York.
The Democratic presidential ticket is off on another campaign bus trip. In East St. Louis, Illinois today, presidential nominee Bill Clinton drew loud applause when he promised to help the homeless. The Arkansas governor said it was crazy to have homeless people sleeping near boarded-up houses owned by the federal government. Stock prices closed lower on Wall Street today, with the Dow Jones Industrials losing 19 points to finish at 3365. This is NPR. The Census Bureau today postponed a decision on whether to use population estimates instead of its 1990 count. The Bureau counted 248 million Americans in 1990, but its own studies show the count was inaccurate. The Bureau estimates the true population is about 252 million. The decision will affect about $10 billion in federal spending. Big cities charge the census undercounts their populations, meaning less federal dollars. A Michigan Circuit Court judge has upheld the state's ability to require teenagers to obtain parental consent before getting an abortion. However, Judge Philip Schaefer says the law cannot be enforced until lawmakers redefine medical emergencies that could be exceptions to the law. Tony Griffin of member station WMUK reports.
Today's ruling is quite narrow. The judge said parental consent cannot be enforced because there's no clear definition of when doctors may perform abortions on teens without consent or the judicial waiver. Violation of the law subjects doctors to criminal and civil liability. And the judge said no physician should have to guess what may or may not be an appropriate act under the law. Officials for Planned Parenthood and the ACLU, who sued to stop the law, are pleased with today's ruling, and each claims the matter is winnable upon appeal. The defendant, State of Michigan, and Michigan Right to Life said they'll know by the end of the day whether or not they will appeal. They have 21 days to do so. For National Public Radio in Kalamazoo, this is Tony Griffin.
In South Africa, a hearing on the Boipatong massacre began today. One witness said police ignored hundreds of men who crept into the township just before the killing started. 42 blacks were killed in Boipatong, just south of Johannesburg. The African National Congress broke off political reform talks in protest. The ANC demands the government do more to stop township violence before the talks resume. Police have arrested 94 people living in a workers' hostel in the killings. Most of the hostel residents are Zulus. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air.
Yes, sir, when you see a guy reach for stars in the sky, you can bet that he's doing it for some doll.
When you spot a John waiting out in the rain, chances are he's insane, as only a John can be for a Jane.
When you meet a gent paying all kinds of rent for a flat that could flatten a Taj Mahal,
call it sad, call it funny, but it's better than even money. That guy's only doing it for some doll.
We're listening to the new cast recording of the current Broadway revival of Guys and Dolls. We're going to find out how Guys and Dolls first became a musical from one of the men who created it. My guest, Cy Feuer, was one of the producers of the original 1950 production. Feuer and his partner, Ernest Martin, came up with the idea of a musical based on a Damon Runyon story. And they hired composer Frank Lesser, who gave us one of Broadway's best scores. Together, Feuer and Martin also produced two Cole Porter musicals, Can Can and Silk Stockings, as well as The Boyfriend, How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying, and Little Me. More recently, they produced Liza Minnelli's review The Act and the film adaptations of A Chorus Line and Cabaret. Feuer's story of Guys and Dolls begins with one of those proverbial phone calls.
My partner called me from California. There was and he had just finished reading a book called Guys and Dolls. There's no story called Guys and Dolls. This was a collection of Runyon stories. And he called me and he said he thought it was that the idea of doing a Runyon musical, what did I think of it? But we were both Runyon fans, and I responded to it. And also, he thought that Guys and Dolls was a terrific title.
How did you decide on Frank Lesser to write the score? A great choice, obviously.
Well, Frank did our first show. The show before the Guys and Dolls. And also, Frank and I go way back together. I was a musical director and knew Frank. As a matter of fact, I put Frank and Julie Stein together on a picture out at Republic. So we were all old friends. And Frank, at that time, was principally a lyricist. He did not write the music. He had done a few things in the Army during the war. But he was really a lyricist working with some very well-known composers. And we used him on our first show.
That was Where's Charlie?
And Where's Charlie, yes. Hal Arlen was supposed to do the music and Frank the lyrics for Where's Charlie. And we were all living in California at the time. And at that time, Harold's house burned down, and his wife was very upset. She was having some problems anyway. And his burned down with all the memorabilia and everything that they owned. And he came to us and said, look, fellas, I can't go to New York. I've got too much. This is too upsetting. The family is just in disarray, and I just can't go. And Frank said, upon hearing this, said to me, listen, why don't you let me do the whole thing? And we decided to do that. And he did.
So that's how Frank Lesser actually started writing music?
Well, he wrote music before that. He wrote Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition in the Army.
Oh, wow. And, I didn't realize that was his.
Yeah, and he wrote a Western song that was kind of popular. A few things before Where's Charlie. He was just getting into it at the time, you know.
So what was the first song Frank Lesser showed you for Guys and Dolls?
Oh, the first thing he did, I think this was the first, because we never knew where to put it. He wrote it without, and just in general tone of Runyon, was the fugue for Tin Horns.
I've got a horse right here. His name is Paul Revere. That
right.
One.
Because that had the general tone of Runyon. And oddly enough, we had the whole show assembled. We didn't know where to put it. It didn't fit in anything. It had nothing to do with the plot. It was about horse playing. And ours was about crap shooting, you know what I mean? And we never dealt with horse players.
Yeah.
But this was a generic gambler thing, you know what I mean, which he wrote. And it was sensational. And it was dangling there. And Ernie came up with the idea, and he said, listen, if we don't know where to put it, let's open with it, because it doesn't have to do with anything. We haven't established any characters yet, so let them just open with it. And we did. We put it into the opening, establishing just the gambling attitude of three of our characters, having nothing to do with the main plot.
It's a great song. Why don't I play some of it?
I got the horse right here. The name is Paul Revere. And here's a guy that says if the weather's clear, can do, can do. This guy says the horse can do. If he says the horse can do, can do, can do. I take him down at tight, but on the morning line, the guy has got me figured at 5 to 9.
That's the Fugue for Tin Horns from the original cast recording of Guys and Dolls. My guest was the original producer of Guys and Dolls, Cy Feuer. Let's talk about the cast of the original production. We just heard a little bit from Stubby K. I think this was the first musical Stubby K was ever in.
That's right.
He'd been in the Catskills before that?
Yeah, he'd been in the Catskills. He was a tenor and an entertainer. He might have done some nightclub work. And he was a complete total amateur. It was really kind of darling the way he approached the whole thing. And the show was directed by George Kaufman, who was very eminent, eminent director and big theatrical figure, you know. And he kind of dazzled Stubby. And when Stubby would read a line, he'd read his line and he'd walk down the footlights leading edge of the stage and said, "Was that okay, Mr. Kaufman?" And Kaufman called everybody very formally, very formally. He said, "Yes, Mr. K, that's just fine. Just continue. You don't have to check with me after every line. Just read."
You know, it's funny. Stubby K was unknown when he was casting Guys and Dolls. It became, I think it was a rule for a while that you couldn't put on a musical comedy unless Stubby K was in it.
That's right. He became very prominent. He also had a movie career that was very good.
Now, I think you cut one of the numbers right before opening night.
Yeah, you got a lot of this information. Yeah, as a matter of fact, there was a number called Traveling Light. It was a number in 5/4, actually, written by Frank, which is an unusual meter to write a song in. And it was done by Sam Levine and Bob Alder. And Sam was terrible. He just couldn't sing at all. He was kind of tone deaf. And we had them doing this number, and we struggled through it all throughout the out of town, and it was just awful. And finally, I said to everybody, "Listen, I've had enough of this. We're going to get rid of it." And Sam was a difficult man, you know, very tough. So it was before the first preview in New York at the 46th Street Theater. And I called the company on the stage, and I said, "I want you all to take note of this, because there's a cut, and you all have to pay attention, because it'll affect all of the cues and your entrances and everything. Be prepared, because it's a 3-minute cut in this particular scene. And I want the stage managers to note this. Let your wardrobe people know about it in case it affects the change and so forth." And I made this long speech, never getting to what the cut was, you know. And finally, I had the door. There was a door on the side of the auditorium. It led right on onto 46th Street, you see, where I had a cab waiting, you see. And I said, "We're cutting Traveling Light." I saw Sam go white, and I went out the door and jumped into the cab and left.
You were afraid they were going to be so angry that you better get the heck out of there?
Just Sam, yeah. And there was nobody that he could yell at, because there was nobody around to reverse the decision, you know.
So did they follow your orders after you fled?
Yeah. Well, I told the stage manager and everything beforehand. This was what it was going to be, and we cut it.
Was it a good song?
Wonderful. I had Traveling Light. Yes, I'm Traveling Light. Got my ticket in my pocket, and I'm ready to blow town. It's in a 5/4 tempo. Very odd.
Uh-huh. Gee, I wonder if anybody's recorded it.
No, it's never been recorded.
Huh. I'd like to hear that sometime. What are your memories of opening night of Guys and Dolls?
Terrific. When the trumpet played First Call, you know, we'd done that whole opening and everything, and then the three guys went to the newsstand and picked up the scratch sheets, and the trumpet played. It was a big laugh. And I turned to my wife and I said, "We're home. This is it. They're ready.
My guest is Cy Feuer, a producer of the original Broadway production of Guys and Dolls. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Broadway producer Cy Feuer is my guest. Now, Guys and Dolls, the revival is the hottest ticket on Broadway. Did you ever want to do a revival of the show?
We did one. We did when Ernie and I were running the Civic Light Opera at the Los Angeles, at the Los Angeles Music Center. We did it with Milton Berle.
Oh.
And it's such a chestnut now. You know, every high school kid in the country has his particular part. And
should I tell you about my summer camp production?
There you go. You know, there was a symposium of high school kids, and I went down and addressed it one day. When they told them that I had produced Guys and Dolls, the whole bunch jumped up. Every kid in the audience, and each one of them had a part.
That's right.
And they came from all different high schools, you know, and some of them came out from New Jersey and so forth, not even local. So, therefore, I was very surprised at the idea. You know, it's like you're telling old jokes at the impact of it.
Yeah. So have you seen the new revival?
Yes, I have.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I like it very much.
Uh-huh.
It's very slick and up to date. I thought that what they've done with it is generally very good for contemporary audiences.
What are the big changes they've made?
They haven't any change. They stuck very, very closely to the text, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They've made no changes at all. As a matter of fact, even the out-of-date references to Saxon Clines and Hollanderizing and stuff like that, which is no longer applicable today, they've kept that all in. As a matter of fact, I discussed it with them. With Jerry and
Jerry's exit director.
Yeah, and Tony Walton, the designer, and they wanted to know certain things about the construction of the show, which was originally done in what we call one in depth.
Yeah.
It was before you had the state of the art winching that we now use to change scenery. You used to be able to have to bring in a traveler or a curtain in order to change the set. Otherwise, you see the stagehands running around. And the show was designed for that originally, and they decided to keep it that way.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the movie with Marlon Brando and Frank Sinatra?
I saw it recently again. I liked it better this time than I did originally.
It's funny. I have the same reaction. I mean, I like it more as time goes on.
I thought that Sinatra was absolutely wrong for, Sam Levine, Brother Nathan Detroit, is really Jewish. We wrote it with Sam Levine in mind, and he's supposed to be Jewish and have that feel Jewish feeling. And Sinatra tried to play it that way, but he's not. You know, it's flesh and blood. And actually, I thought he would have been a better Sky Masterson. But having seen it recently, I thought that Brando was pretty good.
Yeah, yeah.
And I thought that Gene Simmons was the best Sarah Brown I've ever seen. She was marvelous. She had exactly the right quality. The right flesh and blood.
Two of the shows that you did, Can Can and Silk Stockings, had scores by Cole Porter.
Yeah.
Let me ask you what it was like to work with him.
Great. He was just great. Cole was departmental. Cole, when we first went with him, we would defer to him, you know, after it was the great Cole Porter.
Yeah.
And we said, well, here's our idea. We want to do a show about the Toulouse-Lautrec era in Paris, up at Montmartre. He thought it was wonderful. We said, okay, now here's the story. He said, wait a minute, boys, don't tell me the story. Tell me the story. Tell me what you want me to write. In other words, you can tell me the terms of the story and what it has to be, but don't ask me to participate in it because I'm no good at that. So you guys go on, do your job, and when it's all done, I'll read it, and then you tell me what the attitudes are, and I'll write it. And he was like in a classroom being given an assignment, you know, and that's the way he liked to work.
Were you happy with all the songs he wrote, or did you have to tell him that you didn't like one of them?
Yeah, sure. In Can Can, he wrote a song, a comedy song in Can Can, and it was absolutely wrong. And I went up to I worked with him principally because my job with Fewer and Martin was to do or work on the creative end of it, and Ernie worked more or less on the business end, also had some distance on it and could comment on things with a little more objectivity than I could, being involved. At any rate, I went up to see Cole, and I told him that I didn't think the song was quite right. He took it off the piano, and he tore it up. So I said, wait a minute. I said, you know, I just said that I don't like it, but maybe you ought to look at. No, no, he said, if you don't like it. Now, he said, I'll do another song, but I can't do it on the same subject. So give me another subject. Give me other jokes.
Did you have to give yourself some kind of pep talk before saying to Cole Porter that the song wasn't going to work?
No, because of his personality. It was very easy. We had worked up a very good working relationship with him, and he was oddly enough, excited about working with us, because that was the next show after Guys and Dolls.
Oh, yeah.
And so it was very easy, and he made it easy for you, you know. And I was a musician, so that made it easier as well.
How do you think Broadway has changed since the 1950s when you started, or late 1940s when you started?
Well, principally, we were really in the, in the 40s. Principally in the financing. It's just amazing what the difference in costs are. As a matter of fact, that's one of the reasons that we're not too enthusiastic about producing any longer, because by the time you raise the money, you don't have anything left for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we used to do, for instance, Guys and Dolls, on one of its best days, took in more at the box office in one day than the original show cost.
You're kidding.
No. I think the original show cost probably around $175,000 or $200,000 or something like that. And they took in more than that at the box office in one day's sale.
Now, how does that compare with the ratio now?
The show probably cost over $5 million.
And you're not going to get that in one day at the box office, that's for sure. I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
No, I enjoyed it.
Cy Feuer produced the original production of Guys and Dolls. Here's more music from the revival. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Terry, the Los Angeles police officers who were acquitted in the beating trial of Rodney King have been indicted again, this time under the federal civil rights statute. We will be talking to an incumbent congressman who lost in the Michigan primary. This is a man who is the chairman of the committee which attempts to re-elect and elect Republicans to the House. President Bush was speaking on family values to the Knights of Columbus in New York and took a very strong position against abortion, and we'll be talking to someone who was in Sarajevo at the funeral of the children yesterday.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. David Gurevich doesn't watch much television, but he's been glued to the Olympics, and he's thinking about a lot more than who's winning.
When I was growing up in Russia, they didn't show the Olympics on TV. I wouldn't have watched anyway. I mean, these guys were pumped with steroids and then shipped abroad with KGB handlers to prove the superiority of communism. Yuck. My friends and I, we were too hip to buy that. What we did, we bought Levi's from them. That was what athletes did in Russia. They traveled abroad to shop and resell the goods on the black market. Now, of course, the athletes travel freely. But the system that footed the bill is gone, and they have to hustle for sponsors. I don't gloat like some American commentators who talk about the last show for the gymnastics team. Gymnastics is to Russian kids what basketball is to Americans. I wouldn't be surprised if 4 years from now, the gymnastics medals would go to Russia, Ukraine, and Belarus in any order. That's three dream teams right there. Not only will the commentators eat their words, they'll have to learn to pronounce a lot more new names. But for the moment, as I look at those unified team kids who flip back and forth like they had no bones, I feel a little sorry for them. I know it's irrational. The best of them already have agents and contracts waiting for them in the bountiful West. But that will come later. Right now, they have to earn the applause. I'm talking about the hugs, the signs, and the applause the American athletes get from their family and friends. I don't think that the family of Tatiana Gutsu, the all-round champion in women's gymnastics, has money to travel to Barcelona, stay at a hotel, and film Tatiana's every medal-winning somersault with a video camera. They were happy to get an apartment of their own as a reward, which is why the unified team members have an underdog look about them, despite all their high marks. At least they are now part of the club. What about the rest? There's still a lot of Olympians about whom we know absolutely nothing. What about Mongolian wrestlers, Turkish weightlifters, Indonesian badminton players? For us to see non-American athletes, they must compete against Americans, run track like Kenyans, or play basketball like Lithuanians. And if they get sponsored by a rock and roll band, that's even better. A ready-made cause, sort of like human rainforest. We learn about the rest of the world as if by accident. I mean, who would know about Spanish yachting team if they didn't have a real prince aboard? Would we get to see judo at all if an Israeli hadn't won a medal? Okay, so it's their first medal, special relationship, etc. But if you are from Indonesia, you can win every badminton medal you want. You won't ever get your own Coke commercial. So how did the Indonesians come to dominate a sport that we only play on the lawns with a few beers under our belts? I want to know. Do we need to wait for National Geographic to run that story? I'm not saying let's show every qualifying game, but a taste of it would be nice. Surely NBC can back their choices with demographic studies to prove that Americans care more about what Mike Jordan would wear for the medal ceremony than about badminton champions. If it's true, that's too bad. We see a lot of Mike, whether we want it or not. What about the rest? We'll get another chance in 4 years, if we're lucky.
David Gurevich is the author of From Lenin to Lenin. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Joan Tuohy, with Sue Weinstein and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the war and famine in Somalia. We talk with Rakia Omar, the executive director of the human rights group Africa Watch. She's Somalian and just visited refugee camps in Ethiopia and Somalia. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.